Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Oh, geez. God. I'm in the middle of an email, man, and you just fired up, and I don't even know if I start today. Yes, I do.
It's my fault. It's my fault.
Oh, man. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood. Good grief. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we're crushing it tight as a drum. None of us is as smart as all of us. It's one of those thank goodness for all of you days.
Oh, my Lord.
Limping toward the finish. We're like those marathon runners who just crawl across the line at the end.
So it being Tuesday, single topic deep dive for the whole show, and we're going to get into something a lot of you have been asking about. Here's just one of the voice memos that we've gotten on this.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Will in New Orleans. Recently, my wife forwarded to me an article from Forbes where President-elect Biden called for forgiveness of up to $10,000 worth of federal student loans. Our question is, what would potentially be the effect of this on the U.S. economy, and is this feasible as an executive order if or when Congress fails to act?
So, okay, we cannot, to be fair, we are going to do a deep dive into the economics of this topic. We probably can't answer the second part on the legality of, you know, and how and when laws could be created. But this is a big question, a big topic, and potentially, you know, I think everybody agrees, a big economic drag. 42 million Americans or so hold a total of $1.6 trillion in student debt. The idea, of course, being like, that's all they can do. They can't buy houses. They can't have kids. They can't, you know, contribute to the economy, invest in the stock market, because all they do is pay down that debt. And so there are now proposals coming out about canceling some part of this debt. The Biden plan that Will mentioned, and then Senators Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren are proposing to cancel more like $50,000 of people's debt.
So those are just two of the proposals. We're going to look, though, at the broader conversation about canceling student debt, what it might mean for borrowers and for this economy. Making us smart on this is Susan Donarski. She's a professor of public policy, education, and economics at the University of Michigan. Professor Donarski, welcome to the pod. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So do me a favor and let's frame this thing, right? You're a trained observer of the American economy. How big a problem is $1.6 trillion in student debt?
It's a problem insofar as it is harming people in their lives, right? So I tend to think about the people as opposed to the dollars. And the first thing to realize about this debt is that a majority of borrowers actually have pretty small amounts of debt. So the news headlines tend to be about those with, say, $150,000, but the typical person who gets a BA, say, borrows $30,000. And many, many people go to school for just a semester and have like $5,000.
And is the problem, give us a sense of the overall economic problem. How much of it is then? Is it about defaulting? Is it about not being able to participate in the economy like we talked about? Like, where do all these problems come in?
I would say that the key problem is in default and in repayment problems, right? So in terms of a macro level, is this a big drag on the economy? I do not think so. In terms of micro level, are there people whose lives are ruined by fairly small amounts of debt? Yes, because if you go into default on your loans, your credit is ruined. You know, the cost of getting a credit card goes up, cost of getting a car goes up. There are some employers who will check your credit before they'll hire you. There are landlords who will check your credit. So in general, even if it's a small amount of debt, and in a macroeconomic sense, doesn't make a real difference, for an individual person's life and their ability to participate in the economy and live comfortably, it can make a huge difference.
Can we talk for a second about forgiving debt versus canceling debt? Is it a distinction without a difference? What is that?
I think this is one of those legal distinctions. So as an economist, I'm just going to say that if somebody says you don't need to pay it back, it's forgiven. Mm-hmm. But I understand that there may be some parsing of this language that has to do with whether it can be an executive order versus legislation.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Why this issue? I mean, like you said, is it the sheer amount of dollars? Like, of all of the kind of financial challenges that face a lot of people in this economy, what do you think it is about student debt that is resonating so much politically?
This one's been issue has been floating around for several years. You know, it was one of the key topics that came up in the Occupy movement. Bernie Sanders' campaign made it a central topic. So a lot of people who are energized in the Democratic Party have gone to college, probably have gone to, many of them have gone to elite colleges if they're in the chattering classes, for example. So I think this is a case where the people who talk about policy are also the people who be affected by this, which makes me worry a bit about mm-hmm. those who aren't that active in the policy conversation and whose needs might be actually more severe than a college graduate with $30,000 in debt.
Yeah, well, so let's pick up on that, actually. Who ought to be in this conversation? Because, you know, Vice President or President-elect Biden, rather, is surrounding himself at the moment with people who are going to be making these decisions for him. Who do you think ought to be at the table?
We should be thinking in terms of what else the money could be spent on. Right. So, you know, the money could be spent, for example, on $1,200 checks to everybody in the economy. Right. So in the sense that each dollar that is spent on loan forgiveness could instead be spent on something else that has more broad-based impact. You know, we still are at a place where, you know, a good chunk of the population doesn't even go to college. So if the very first thing that Biden does going into office is to forgive the debt of people who, on average, are doing the best in our economy, I think it doesn't send a great signal.
Mm-hmm. Right. This gets to this idea that student loan forgiveness is regressive, right? That it helps people who don't need the help?
Exactly. Now, you know, a minority of borrowers own a majority of the debt or owe a majority of the debt. So, you know, where I said that most of the debt is people who went undergraduate, their debts are under, say, 30,000. A minority of borrowers are folks who've gotten professional degrees, MBAs, lawyers, doctors, and they're the ones that have the large debts. So certainly a complete forgiveness program would be regressive because it would overwhelmingly benefit people who have professional degrees who tend to earn high wages. A more limited forgiveness around, you know, in the range of 10,000 is disproportionately going to affect those people who went to college just for a short time. I have in the past not thought forgiveness was a great idea, but as I've watched attempts to reform our loan repayment system founder repeatedly, I've come to believe that some form of forgiveness might be useful. We have a lot of very small debts that would be expensive to collect, but they're expensive for people to hold because we have such a lousy repayment system.
I don't want to let this conversation go by without talking about the root cause, right, which is the cost of higher education in this country. What do we do to make sure that even if we establish some kind of forgiveness now at whatever benchmark, 10,000, 50,000, I don't know, we're not back here inside a generation because the cost of higher education keeps on going up.
The key driver of education costs is state support or lack thereof to public institutions. So most people, 80% of people go to public institutions, community colleges, state universities. Tuition has gone up at those schools, not because of some weird economic process, but just the fact that states aren't giving them money. So the money has to come from somewhere. So instead they take it from students. So efforts to make, say, community college free would help a bunch. Traditionally, community college students have not borrowed for college. That changed during the Great Recession. And that's where a lot of the problems with default are, is people who in the past we haven't had borrow. BAs, professional degrees, those folks don't tend to default. It's the folks who go for a year or two to a community college who we tend to lose.
Hmm.
And that's why we should say this is often put in a context and through the lens of racial justice, right? Because it disproportionately affects those who didn't complete their degrees, Black borrowers, first-generation immigrants have higher default rates.
Yes, yes. So there is no question that the population of folks who have these small debts but nonetheless tend to get in trouble with them are disproportionately first-gen, non-white immigrants, folks who are challenged in the economy anyway. Now, if we're looking at this through a lens of racial justice and we want to reduce inequality and say in wealth, racial inequality and wealth, the loan system is not the first place I would think of because a minority of the folks we just described go to college. Right. So starting a policy amongst those who have attempted college is not going to reach a majority of, say, African-Americans. That speaks to the broader issue of distribution and regressivity. Right. So anything that is focused on student loans is going to only hit the people who go to college. And a lot of people don't go to college.
Yes. What do we do about that? Right. I mean, keep going with that thought, because there's fodder there somehow.
Generally, we don't think of forgiving debts as a way to stimulate the economy, because paying off debts doesn't send money circulating back into, you know, stores, the local economy. We tend to think of instead giving people money that they can use to go consume things, right? And that's why we think that, say, Social Security benefits, goose those and you'll get more spending right away. Paying off student loans is not the first thing I would think of in terms of stimulating the economy. The only reason it could be effective is because we have a system that is so broken that causes people with pretty small debts to end up in these defaults, which mess up their lives. So stopping those defaults could have a stimulatory effect, right? It could, a stimulating effect. It could result in those people being able to buy homes, to get better jobs, to get cars. So the reason why a limited forgiveness could work well is because our loan system is so broken.
Tell us more about that. What's the part that's broken?
Well, we have a pretty unforgiving system. The standard way that people pay back their loans is through a 10-year mortgage-style payment, right? Level payment for 10 years. And the thing is that an education pays off over a lifetime. And in fact, the first 5 or 10 years out of college tend to be the ones where people have the most unstable incomes. Now, a natural way to fix this would be what Australia does, what England does, which is to have income-based repayment where you pay a percentage of your wages. Your wages are zero, you're not paying. Your wages go up, you pay a bit more towards your loans. And these systems work quite well. In theory, we have such a system, but it doesn't adjust automatically. It's backward-looking. You file your taxes for last year with the loan agency, and they give you a payment based on what you earned last year, which is not very helpful if you're a young worker with very variable earnings right now. And in fact, right now, given this recession, last year's earnings are predictive for a very small share of people in our economy.
Right. Yeah. So speaking of this year and the pandemic and the recession, does that change calculus at all? I mean, we're looking at a multi-year problem here, right? It's not like this. It's exacerbated a lot of things this pandemic has. Maybe not this issue, though.
It's exacerbated in the sense that folks who were near default anyway have been pushed over the edge economically, right? So, you know, the folks that, you know, a year ago were having trouble repaying a small loan, many of them this year are having trouble repaying, paying for their rent and their food. So any economic downturn, and this one is a doozy, is going to make loan repayment harder. Another key thing coming up as we roll into the new year and restart payment is because we have this very clunky repayment system that's run by contractors that the Department of Education hires, they're anticipating that restarting payment is going to be a nightmare.
Great.
Okay. But so it sounds
there's
like
just
what
layers
you're...
and layers of dysfunction here. If you were hoping for a very simple economic story, it's not.
Yeah.
No, there always are, actually. And I think that's what is so important to point out, is that a million factors go into this and that sometimes the fix can make things worse. And it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, that there is a case to be made for limited forgiveness, but that if a bill gets introduced, we should all be looking for some structural reform on the back end that will keep, yes, the problem from just cropping back up.
Because it will. So one piece of that is that make it so people who go to community colleges don't borrow, as historically has been the case, right? So because they have the most problems repaying. Get the for-profit colleges out of the student aid system, because that is where big debts that go into defaults come from. And perhaps if we're giving people $10,000, you know, it could make it a condition that if you take that $10,000, you're automatically going to get enrolled in an income-based program, which we make functional.
Hmm. You know, what's funny about this story, it's a classic one of push a little here, pull a little there, and it trickles down through so many other parts of this economy. It's kind of amazing. Susan Donarski is a professor of public policy education, also economics at the University of Michigan. Sue, thanks for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how about that?
So good. So yeah. I mean, this is what I love about the show, is like the layers of the onion.
Yeah, that's literally what it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Life is the story of unintended consequences, friends. If you are interested in hearing more about how student loan debt has affected people personally, check out the Marketplace podcast. This is Uncomfortable. A few episodes back, they actually did talk with a woman who worked at a call center who was basically hounding people who had fallen behind on their student loans while she herself also had $70,000 in college debt. It's a little brutal. Yeah. And we will have a link to it in the show notes at makemesmart.org.
Yep. So now what do we do? Oh, yeah. The break? The break.
Yeah. Or you can email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and then now we will take the break.
I figure people knew that.
He was thinking. Kai was just thinking about it.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Saved from ourselves again. Welcome back, everyone. Let's do the news fix.
Do the news. As I sit here in an abandoned Marketplace World headquarters, 20,000 square feet, three people in here for the past 6 months, me and two guys who make everything work, I came across this item yesterday. CNBC reports that Google CEO Sundar Pichai has said, okay, first of all y'all are not coming back to the office till the 1st of September, but we're not doing any of this permanent work from home garbage. I expect you to live within commuting distance of the office. And I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, Google's a big company. We take our cues. A lot of the rest of the companies in this economy do from the big companies. And for all the push toward, oh, we're all going to work from home after this is over, not all the companies are on board. And I thought that was worth a note because of the many things we're not really sure of, what the office environment is going to look like is one of them. And here's somebody weighing in.
Yeah. I also think I do think it's interesting that Google is going to work on a hybrid work model where they realize that, you know, for some people, it is nice to have some time. I mean, everybody, I would warrant that if you surveyed every worker you could find who worked in an office, that like the vast, vast majority of them would say, yes, I would love to be in the office 2 to 3 days a week and have a couple days to work from home to get some damn stuff done and not be in meetings. And that is exactly what Google is proposing for its employees who don't need to spend a lot of time with clients or be on site in data centers, is that there will be this like hybrid model, which, yay, love it. Yeah. Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
But take note of that timeline, by the way.
Yeah, September.
September 1st, because previously it was July.
Oh, I know. They're dreaming. Well, look, as far as I know, corporate overlords here at Marketplace are still saying March 31st. And I'm like, hello, is anybody in St. Paul listening to this podcast? Because it's
adorable.
Not happening on March 31st.
Just adorable. Middle of the school year. Not for nothing. Middle of the school year.
Yeah.
And yeah, no. Yeah. I'm going to just plan on doing whatever Google's doing.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
For sure.
Hey, so you know how I'm super interested in the post office?
Yes. I saw your tweet the other day. I have an anecdote once you've done your item.
Yeah, you're not the only one, but wow.
Yeah.
So it turns out, and our very own Mariel Segura is hard at work on the small business ramifications of this. But there are two things happening. One is that the post office is really a mess right now, right? There are huge delays. FedEx and UPS have like cut off deliveries for some retailers, meaning that they're all trickling down to USPS. As far as we know, there was some reversal of taking out mail sorting machines, but some of it just wasn't possible. There are big delays. The Postal Service told Congress that in the week of November 28th, only 78.9% of first-class mail was delivered on time. Its internal goal is 96%.
Sheesh.
Yeah, it is a huge problem that is only going to get worse because of the huge surge in pandemic mail. But it is worth noting, once again, because corruption puts a stain on everything, right, in terms of trust. Yes, we are in the middle of a pandemic and shopping online. I got a stat today that said that Cyber Monday was the single biggest online shopping day in American history. And UPS and FedEx, for reasons we discussed on the Marketplace Tech podcast, are unable to scale up incredibly quickly and, frankly, aren't inclined to make a massive investment in an amount of shipping that might not continue after the pandemic. All of that is true. But a thing that is also true is that Louis DeJoy has had a 20-some million dollar stake, sorry, $30 to $70 million interest in XPO Logistics, which is a private logistics company that got a big contract with the post office in October or in August, and that Louis DeJoy had not previously divested. As of early in November, according to citizensforethics.org crew, which is constantly filing ethics-related lawsuits, Louis DeJoy seems to be divesting his interest by transferring it to his adult children, which is, while technically legal, often referred to as a, quote, sham divestiture, because his children could later return the assets to DeJoy.
I'm sorry, can I just interject here? Isn't that what the president of the United States did? Said his children were going to be running the company? Yes, okay.
Yep. Yeah. Also, Steve Mnuchin transferred his interest in an entity that he agreed to divest to his fiance at the time. This is like a thing with this administration. But it is just important to note that at the moment that the USPS is continuing to fall apart, and that affects small businesses who are also not getting any help from Congress, people who need prescriptions, and so on and so on and so on. The guy in charge has a personal financial stake, and a big one, in a private logistics company that's arguably a competitor.
Yep.
That's my thing. The mail.
Okay.
The frickin' mail. Oh, look.
Speaking of the mail.
Look at that.
Nicely done.
Amazing.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
But maybe related. Love it. All right, let's see. What do we got in the mailbag? This is Christine on the topic of Christmas trees.
This is Christine from Minnesota, super fan and co-owner of a Christmas tree farm with my siblings. And looking at our own stock for this Christmas and at our colleagues, I would anecdotally agree that stock is way down. We aren't even bringing any trees to the lots in the largest city near our farm, which is Grand Rapids. We are doing a couple of small lots on the Iron Range and choose and cut on site. This lack of stock is largely because of weather, both too good and too bad. Since trees take 8 to 10 years to grow on average, the drought we had lasting from 2011 to 2014 still impacts us. It not only hurt the profitable trees we had in the fields, but it really did a number on our seedling beds, as it did the seedling beds of much larger commercial nurseries. We also had some really good years, and that allowed the trees to grow too big. The niche market for trees is 6 to 8 feet. Most houses don't know what to do with a 12-foot white spruce. We have responded by diversifying. My brother and his wife, who are the primary caretakers of the farm now, bought a wreath maker this year, and my sister-in-law is making and selling decorative bough baskets and other natural products. We've even taken to renting out the farm for photo shoots and a soon-to-be-released movie. At any rate, just like farmers of any kind, you adapt and you overcome, or you die. Thanks. I love the show.
Or you die. Thanks. I love
that. That is...
Wow. Christine,
that's basically my whole family in a nutshell. That is like, that's so Grandma Pat right there. Or you die.
Man,
you
man,
just do. It's a tough world out there. I love our show because everybody listens, like the people who listen are exactly the people that we want to know about from the,
that's right.
Oh, amazing. That's amazing. Also, good hustle, Christine.
Yeah, no, for sure. Adapt or die, right? That's the way it is. Okay, yeah. So let's see. Yes, me and the Marketplace logo. I hate it. some of you don't, which I just frankly don't understand and what it says about our listenership, contra whatever Ms. Wood says about y'all. Anyway, bless. I asked y'all to weigh in. Here's one hot take.
Hi, Kai and Molly and the awesome Eaton Parrots. So a bit of a rant from Jordan and Asbury Park. That logo is definitely but ugly.
Yes!
So why not have a listener contest where someone far more creative than I will design a logo worthy of a coffee mug? Second, beer is beer, and dessert is dessert, and never the twain shall meet. So I proffer to you, keep your beer, and I will take my Ample Hills in New York ice cream with a coffee base and pumpkin pie in it as just an awesome alternative. Thanks. Been a loyal listener since you began. Appreciate all you do.
I don't even know what that dessert thing was, but there was beer in there. There was logo hatred, so I'm in. Jordan and Asbury Park, man. Good stuff.
And may I posit that the new bent holiday is Eaton Parrots.
Eaton Parrots, yeah, I know, right? Oh, my goodness.
Just Eaton Parrots. However, we should say that the logo also, I swear, I think he starts beef on purpose just to get you guys to call us, and it's working.
Well,
the logo also has fans.
Boo.
Hi, Kai. My name is Samantha Barnes. I am interactive track professor at Tulane University.
Oh, nice.
And a digital designer for over 10 years, graduated with a BFA from Nicholls State University. I definitely have to disagree with you. I think it's a beautiful logo. It does all of the things that your former boss said it does based on, I'm going to say, previous designers' brand guide expectations and research. I think it's lovely branding. It stands out for me every time I look for it on the Spotify podcast list. And I can easily see which are Marketplace shows and which aren't. So I guess, unless you have any better ideas, because technically you're wrong, everyone can draw. You just need to practice. I think we should see your ideas.
Put up or shut up, Kai. No, I don't have any ideas. I'm a word guy. I do words.
Don't you have that fancy iPad Pro? Can't you get yourself one of those pencils?
Yes, I'm sure I can scribble on it and whatever.
Sketch something out of there.
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
That's too funny.
That was a throwdown is what that was. Uh-huh.
That was a good one.
And now we will leave you with an answer to the Make Me Smart question, which of course is, what is something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about, and all I have to say is, wah, wah, wah.
Hey there, it's me, Ethan Parrott, the world's hardest working intern, here with my answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something I thought I knew, but later found out I was wrong about? I used to think I could deal with a crummy showerhead. I just moved into a new apartment with a bad shower head, and what used to be the best part of kickstarting my day, a nice shower, was suddenly demoted to third best part of kickstarting my day, behind a walk and some breakfast.
Who lists this
And
stuff?
I thought I could deal with that.
Love this.
But boy, was I wrong.
Oh, yeah.
I soon came to absolutely dread the weak scattershot of water I used to clean myself every morning. So I went to Lowe's and invested a hard-earned $15 into a shower head. And suddenly my love affair with showering in the morning was back on. Never underestimate a good shower head.
Oh, man.
Oh, Ethan.
Oh, man. So number
one, greatest.
Who ranks the things that get your day started? I don't know. I feel a little bit like John Cusack in High Fidelity. But
he's
good for
him.
He's
a serious person, Ethan is.
Yes, clearly. More serious than I knew. More serious than I knew.
Thank you for that insightful answer. And hilariously, this is a conversation I literally had yesterday where I was like, well, my big problem with the new house, I don't know where to wash the dogs because none of the tubs have like a removable shower head sprayer. And then my man friend said, why don't you just buy one?
Buy one, yeah.
With mm-hmm. Yeah, turns out you can totally do that. And I was like, that's genius. So there you go. I also underestimated shower heads. Ethan's, I am devastated to report that Ethan's internship with the Marketplace and Make Me Smart crew is wrapping up at the end of this month. Ooh. The longest internship ever. But do not be surprised because we must honor him appropriately. Don't be surprised if you hear more from Ethan this week as we wrap up our final shows of the year.
Yep, yep, yep. All right, so a big announcement on the way out here, courtesy of our giving team. First, though, here's the deal about Make Me Smart and Marketplace and all the stuff that we do. It is trustworthy. It is independent news. It is nonprofit news. It's kind of public service journalism that we believe, and we hope you do too, is worth supporting.
Yeah, and when, of course, you donate, you are joining us on that mission because here's the thing. It's also free. I mean, yes, you donate, and so there technically you pay, but there's no paywall. The truth should not just be for the people who can afford it. Which is a big part of what we do here, and we're proud of it.
Absolutely. So here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to raise $500,000 by the end of this month, which is 15, 16 days from right now.
Yep. We are serious, and that is a whole lot of journalism, but we believe we can do this. $500,000.
We're more than halfway there. We got about $200,000 left to go. So help us out if you can.
Yeah. Every gift, no matter how small, makes a huge difference. Please give today. Go to marketplace.org/givesmart. Thank you.
And thank you very much. All right. That's it for us. Tomorrow, what do you want to know? Wednesday, still time to send your questions. I know we don't say it enough, so I'm going to say it again. makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Says the man who tried to skip it.
I know,
I think
right?
They know.
I know.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ethan Peretz, maybe you heard, is our intern. And always will be. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speakers.
We're going to have to get all our new interns to change their name to Ethan Peretz because I'm not
pretty much.
Today's show was engineered, as I said. Garrett Lang did the work across on the other side of the soundproof glass. Emma Erdbrink is going to mix it later. Donna Tam. Still around, filling for our senior producer, Bridget Bonner. She's out on family leave. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves.
Crushing it. Apparently, we're going to have to do a whole episode on Ample Hills.
I know, right?
A Navy SEAL who makes precision lasers bought it?
I don't even know.
Murder ice cream?
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.